So good afternoon. I'm Peter Bergerman, and I want to welcome you to the second of our seminars in Reconsidering Early Jewish Nationalist Ideologies. Our guest today, I'm very, very thrilled to introduce to you. She's a colleague and a friend, Danielle Drori. I'll give you a little bit of her biography. Danielle teaches modern Hebrew literature here at Oxford. She holds a PhD in Hebrew and Judaic Studies from New York University and has taught at the City University of New York and the Brooklyn Institute for Social Research. Her research focuses on the ties between the literary translation and nationalism, bringing together contemporary theories of cultural transfer and the study of modern Hebrew literature. Her writing has appeared in several academic and popular publications, including Proof Texts, a journal of Jewish literary history, Dibur, a literary journal, and the Los Angeles Review of Books. And today she's going to talk to you about a subject which is very close to my heart and my research also, about Josef Klausner and Josef Klausner in translation, Zionism and Christianity. So Danielle, thank you.
Thank you, Peter. Okay, can you hear me? You can, great. So thank you very much for inviting me to participate in the seminar. It is election day in the United States, as you all know. So hopefully this talk is a distraction from the anxiety, even though I might say a few words about America and Israel later, I mean, from the perspective of early Zionist thought. I'm very grateful for being here. I should say that my training is in literary studies, but my current project about translation and Zionism revolves around questions of history and historiography, no less than it does around the analysis of literary texts. So it's nice to have a chance to take part in this ongoing discussion of early Zionist thought and Zionist history. And what I'll present to you today is not about a literary text, but rather about a Hebrew biography of Jesus Christ, written by the scholar, editor, and Zionist thinker Josef Klausner. Klausner was born in a small town in today's Lithuania. It was the Russian Empire at the time. It was 1874. And he became an important figure in the Hebrew literary world, first in Odessa in the early 1900s, then in Jerusalem from the 1920s. He got there in 1919 until his death in 1958. But it's not only the biography that he wrote of Jesus Christ that I'll be talking about, but also the story behind its English translation, a collaboration between Klausner and the Anglican priest Herbert Danby, who was church librarian and a journalist in Jerusalem in the 1920s before becoming the Regius Professor of Hebrew here. I'm in London, but okay, here at the University of Oxford in 1936. Before I get there, however, I'm going to dedicate a considerable amount of time, maybe half of this presentation, to the link between Zionism and translation, because my work on Klausner, and it is a work in progress, is part of a larger project about translation and Zionism that aims to show, among other things, that the study of Zionism could benefit from the study of translation, from looking at translation, from looking at it not only as a linguistic act, but also as a metaphor that Zionist thinkers used, as something that represents more than just that linguistic or cultural transfer. So I will start with a lengthy general introduction about the centrality of translation in early Zionist thought, and then I'll move on to Klausner's work on Christ in translation. I should also say, before I share my screen with you and start my presentation, that Yael Volach's lecture in this seminar 2 weeks ago has prepared us to grapple with some of the questions that I am also interested in, particularly the question of how the Zionist movement nationalized the Hebrew language. And paradoxically, translation was a way to achieve that goal of nationalizing Hebrew. So now I'm going to share my screen and hopefully it works. Does it work? Okay. So here we have some covers of translated literary texts in Hebrew, of course, in the early 1900s. What you can see here on the left is David Frischmann's translation of Lord Byron's work, Cain. So Cain, based on the story from Genesis. And next to it is Frischmann's 1910 translation of Friedrich Nietzsche's Thus Spoke Zarathustra. Frischmann was a Hebrew poet, writer, editor, but also a very important and prolific translator. And next to Frischmann's work, as a translator, you can see Chaim Nachman Bialik's translations of Schiller's Wilhelm Tell and Cervantes' Don Quixote, which is not really a translation. It was an adaptation of an abridged Russian version that Bialik created, consulting the German text as well, German translation as well. This is from 1912, and Wilhelm Tell is from 1923, but we should assume that whatever they published in those years, they had started working on earlier. And we also have Brenner's, Yosef Chaim Brenner, another famous Hebrew writer from the turn of the 20th century, his translation of Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment. That came out in the early 1920s after Brenner's death, but he actually was working on it in 1910-1911. So this is to show you that the Hebrew translation enterprise was growing in the first few decades of the 20th century. And these covers are also beautiful. It was a very popular activity to translate among some writers. And the period in general in modern Hebrew literary historiography is referred to as the revival of modern Hebrew literature, the Renaissance, Hatchia. And most writers of the revival, who also defined themselves as revivalists sometimes, were in Eastern and Central Europe at the time. Some of them later migrated to Palestine and to other places as well. They set out to reinvent Hebrew as a language of literary modernism. Of course, it did not function as anybody's mother tongue at the time, and it was not the vernacular of a national group that also defined itself as a unified, homogeneous national group. As Yair pointed out in his talk, Hebrew only became a spoken language later in history, but for years it had been a language that many Jews, mostly men, all over the world, could read and write. And so it was an effective medium of communication and also of literary circulation, which is my addition to what Yair already told us. Those who believed that Hebrew had to be revived, or rather nationalized, aspired to show all those Hebrew readers that Hebrew was like other living languages, and translation was an effective way to achieve that goal. And this is sort of a thought experiment that I think people were experiencing at the time, maybe unconsciously. If a Hebrew reader picked up a book that was originally written in a spoken language, let's say German, but was rendered anew in Hebrew, that Hebrew reader could think of Hebrew as equivalent to German or really any other spoken language. And even if this would have been an almost unconscious understanding, it would have been very effective. And on a more conscious level, Hebrew readers would simply have another opportunity to consume a book in Hebrew, and not just any book, but one that other groups had already appreciated. So translation really helped create the illusion that some Zionist thinkers had hoped to turn into a reality, that Jews, a scattered minority, were just like other nations, or at least some other nations, and were in possession of a literary canon, of a living literature and a living language. We can think about it as a fantasy of equivalence. Translation helped foster this fantasy of equivalence between Jews and others, because the languages seemed equivalent in translation, even though, of course, any translation scholar would tell you that there is no such thing as perfect equivalence. But it did become a popular activity in the Hebrew literary field. And the Hebrew literary field in general was a major arena for shaping the Zionist movement in the first few decades of the 20th century. to such a degree, the debates around literature and literature in translation were often as heated as debates around the so-called Jewish question and the Zionist answer or answers to it. In fact, the more readers expressed interest in Hebrew literature and the Zionist movement, and this wasn't always a linear process, the more questions began to be asked about the right balance between original and translated Hebrew works in the Hebrew publishing world and the Hebrew literary field. So although many famous Hebrew writers who were also Zionist figures also translated, they sometimes became skeptical of translation. And that's something that I also wanted to show you. So here we have, you know, a picture of Chaim Nachman Bialik, very famous poet. I think it's fair to call him a Zionist figure as well. And in 1905, he publishes an essay entitled Language Pangs, Chevlei Lashon, in which he discusses the poverty of the Hebrew language, as well as organic defects. And so he determines in this essay that Hebrew, which is a dead language, or at least half dead, is not strong enough to endure translation. He criticizes Hebrew writers' growing use of translation, mainly of single words, but also of complete works. And then he insists that translation would only weaken the Hebrew language and its literature. It would reveal how limited its vocabulary is compared to the vocabularies of living languages. So he believed that if Hebrew writers focused more on original creation, they could strengthen Hebrew literature from within. And he had this wish that later, of course, was fulfilled, that a comprehensive Hebrew dictionary would be produced, maybe jointly, a few Hebrew writers and lexicographers taking part in that project. Now, the very idea that a language lacks strength deserves some scrutiny, especially as it is reminiscent of the Zionist claim that I think many of you would know, that the Jews were a dependent, weak group everywhere. And this is the thing, that Zionist image of a helpless diasporic nation made its way to discussions of translation and the Hebrew language itself in the early 20th century, in the form of these complaints about the degeneration of the language, of the literature, and translation was sometimes seen as part of that degeneration. And even though Bialik later translated Schiller and Cervantes and also experimented with translation before publishing this essay, Language Pangs, he still resisted translation when it seemed to him to be taking over original literary production. And he was not the only one. So here we see Brenner, Yosef Chaim Brenner, who in 1909 publishes a review of a few Hebrew works, both original and translated. It was titled From the World of Our Literature. And alongside the other publications he reviewed, Brenner reviewed Henrik Ibsen's Norwegian play, A Doll's House, in its first Hebrew translation. Frischmann was the translator. And he really disliked the play and therefore criticized the very fact of its translation and publication. And so he stated, and you have it as a quotation on your slide, "People might say, even if this translation does not do us any good, it would not do us any harm. No, I say, it will do us harm. Our literary energy, do I even need to mention it? It is sparser than sparse, and we should not waste it." So Brenner is known as a writer for this hyperbolic style, but I think he really means it when he says we have limited literary energy. And again, this was just a replication or another way of saying that Jews, the Hebrew culture, were weak, had limited energy and had to focus their energy in a very deliberate way on the right kind of goals. And Brenner too was a translator. He'd started translating even before publishing this review essay, but it did not stop him from criticizing specific translation choices. This debate became so heated that at a conference for the Hebrew language and its culture in Vienna in 1913, the chief rabbi of Moscow, Yaakov Maze, attempted to put an end to the dispute about translation, and he called for an inclusive approach to Hebrew publishing. He was basically asking, why should writing in Hebrew and translating into Hebrew be perceived as mutually exclusive activities? He was not a writer himself, so, you know, or he was a writer, as rabbis tend to be, but he wasn't producing any literary works, so maybe to him it seemed easy to do both translating and writing. But he also used an analogy from the world of commerce, which strikes me as interesting. He said humankind is characterized by its drive to exchange goods. So why should anyone object to spiritual exchange more than they do to the exchange of material objects or farming methods, for example? So this was Maze. Things got even more complicated when it came to translations from the Hebrew. So this is where I am now. We have here Jabotinsky, and he is next to the translation of around 40 of Chaim Nachman Bialik's poems into Russian that he produced in the more or less from 1904 to 1910. And then the book itself, the anthology, came out in 1911. And next to him, you can see a picture of Frischmann, whom I already mentioned. When Jabotinsky published this anthology of Bialik's poems in Russian translation, Frischmann promptly attacked him for granting Russians, whom he defined as a nation that persecutes Jews by definition, access into the best poems of the modern Hebrew literary canon. For Frischmann, from his point of view, Russians just didn't deserve that. And Russian-speaking Jews, or Jews who could not read Hebrew but could only read Russian, they also did not deserve access to Bialik's poetry. Specifically, Frischmann insisted that Bialik's laments were untranslatable. So he called some of Bialik's poems laments, for reasons that I think would be obvious for people who've had the chance to read Bialik. And he defined Bialik as a Jewish prophet. And because he was a Jewish prophet, translating his work was like translating the Bible, which in Frischmann's view was always bound to fail, or at least miss the mark. And I think this is a familiar claim about the Bible. Bible scholars in this virtual room may have heard it in other contexts. And it is interesting that Frischmann had his theory about translating Bible-inspired works into Hebrew. You may recall that he's the one who translated Lord Byron's Cain into Hebrew. And he thought that that translation was not really a translation, but a restoration of the work. He used the Hebrew phrase Hashavat Atara LeYoshna, or Hachzarat Atara LeYoshna. So he really did think that something was regained rather than lost in his translation of that work by Byron. And he would say similar things about other works that were clearly inspired by the biblical texts. And of course, there are many works that fall under that category. But he did resist translations from the Hebrew, especially when the biblical texts seemed to be part of that story. So all of these examples point to a dual, even contradictory perception of translation, both from and into Hebrew, among Hebrew writers, against that backdrop of the rise of Zionism. So really the first decades of the 20th century. The writers themselves, they all differed in their views of both literature and politics. All of these writers that I presented to you right now, but also others that could have been part of this presentation. Bialik, for example, subscribed to Zionism, all in all, took the step of migrating to Palestine at some point. Even some of his biographers would tell you that he had other preferences, but he was in Tel Aviv at some point. Brenner often voiced his ambivalence about Zionism. He's very well known for that. And Frischmann actually rejected most Zionist principles, and Frischmann scholars cannot agree whether he was a Zionist or not, especially because it is clear that he contributed on some level to the advent of some Zionist ideas, but he really had a very different vision of Jewish life in Europe. It was not a Zionist answer that he found the best answer to the Jewish question, so to speak. But they all shared this ambivalence about translation, which is what is interesting to me. Here's a sketch of Frischmann and Bialik in Berlin, and maybe they are debating translation and Zionism, who knows? This is by the Russian Jewish painter Leonid Pasternak. Despite the differences between these Hebrew writers, most of them were attracted to the acts and products of translation and skeptical about it, as I already said, skeptical about the short-term and long-term ramifications of translation. I think this reflected a broader ambivalence typical of Zionism vis-a-vis European cultures at large, or the extent to which Zionism represented a move away from Europe or an adoption of European political and philosophical trends. Above all, maybe the idea of modern nationalism. Maybe I'll stop sharing my screen briefly to just make that point, and then I'll move on to Klosnow. I hope it works. So I just stopped sharing my screen. Because Zionism was a European nationalist movement that vowed to end both Jewish assimilation and persecution in Europe, I think it could not afford to betray too intimate a connection with European cultures, nations, religions. But it was still the non-Jewish world from which Zionist thinkers were consciously taking inspiration, not just the non-Jewish world, but definitely also. And this is not a new observation. My goal is to show you that the act and products of translation capture this core tension aptly, this ambivalent relationship with Europe. And my use of this term Europe, it really follows these Hebrew writers' use of the term Europe. Europei, European, is an adjective that they frequently use to refer to the world sometimes. Translation from and into Hebrew was a locus where the aspiration of Jewish self-reliance collided with the recognition that Hebrew culture depended on other cultures to sustain itself. So this is the oscillation between translating, wanting to translate, enjoying translated literature, and not just poetics, but all kinds of texts. But then there's also the concern that Jews are becoming too European, which is of course part of the critique that some Zionist thinkers aimed at Enlightenment thinkers, that they propagated assimilation on some level. So assimilation is another concern, and it is associated with translation. Another way to put it, that Zionist wish to disconnect from the European other, whether culturally or geographically, was also a wish to be like the European other. It was always two sides of the same coin, and translation, again, sort of captures that aptly. And now to get to Klosner, I'll just say that a similar tension frames the Zionist relationship with Christianity as the dominant religion of Europe. Because on the one hand, Zionism was a rejection of any horizon of Jewish-Christian coexistence in Europe. I am putting it bluntly, I know. But on the other hand, most Zionist thinkers adopted at least some general Christian views of Jews as a group that had fallen outside history. And here I'm repeating, maybe crudely, but nevertheless, the historian Amnon Raz Krakotskin's argument about Zionism and how it advanced the idea that Jews had existed outside history from the time of the Second Temple's destruction to the Haskalah, or the Jewish Enlightenment movement, and then Zionism. And Oskar Kotzkin has shown, and he's not the only one, how Zionist thinkers often reworked the premise taken from Christian thought that Jews had fallen behind once they rejected Jesus's teachings. Of course, the Christian solution for that fall, so to speak, would have been conversion, while Zionist thought searched for ways to restore Jews' involvement in global history as Jews. And I'm telling you this because Yosef Klausner was the kind of Zionist thinker who viewed the Zionist idea of return to the land of Israel, Palestine of his day, as the only way to initiate a return to history at large. And he was also very devoted to the study of early Christianity, which turns him into a really interesting case in point, or I should say turns his work into a really interesting case in point. And now I'll share my screen again, and hopefully it works, and you can see Klaus now. Not yet. Let me see. Am I sharing my screen? Okay, and you can see Klaus now. Great. Klausner was not a poet or fiction writer like the other figures I've presented to you, but he was an influential essayist and editor, as well as a historian of modern Hebrew literature. In 1903, he succeeded Ahad Ha'am, a guru maybe of spiritual Zionism, in editing the prestigious journal Hashiloach, and you have your picture of Hashiloach on the slide. And so he became a really important figure in the Hebrew intellectual sphere of the time, and he was quite young. Ahad Ha'am, as the founding editor of Hashiloach, had prioritized essays on Jewish history and European political philosophy. Klausner, on the other hand, found room in it for more or less everything: poetry, essays on European nationalism, archaeological papers, and he himself contributed to the journal articles about Jewish history and the historical calling of Israel. And some of those essays that were published in Hashiloach were then compiled in this anthology by Klausner. You can see it here, Yahadut ve'Enoshiyut, that's the Hebrew title, or Judaism and Humanism. That, and you can see that it came out in Warsaw in 1905. What you also have on your slide is Klausner's home in Jerusalem, and this is after the 1929 riots in Jerusalem. And he placed a sign above his door. Maybe you can see it. It's probably hard because the picture is small and old. And the sign says, Yahadut ve'enoshiyut, just like the title of the anthology, Judaism and Humanism. So these were allegedly the principles of Zionism, as Klausner also explains in most articles in the anthology. You may also be able to see that it says first part, if you can read Hebrew, the cover of Judaism and Humanism. Klausner was really writing essays all the time and then publishing them in anthologies. But to my reading of them is that many of them say more or less the same thing. So what is it that they say? In one way or another, Klausner always argues in these essays that the people of Israel had once been a great source of spiritual teaching in the world. Then they lost that role with the destruction of the Second Temple, their exile from Jerusalem, and in the centuries that followed, they led a ghettoized life of cultural marginality. So his emphasis is often on that cultural marginality. And then the Jewish Enlightenment movement came, the Haskalah. It wished to put an end to that ghettoized existence, but it did espouse education and acculturation at its own peril. It brought about dangerous patterns of assimilation that only Zionism, as a movement of Jewish return to the place where the Jewish people's ancestors once thrived, only Zionism could mend. And this is another aspect of Klausner's essays that becomes a motif. The fact that that the ancestors of Jews really once thrived, they were thriving in that period of Second Temple Judaism. Ezra Kotskin, whose work I already mentioned, has demonstrated such ideas were shared by many Zionist thinkers. Yet Klausnau's ongoing preoccupation with early Christianity and with Jesus' figure specifically is an interesting case study of that Zionist internalization of Christian thought as it is reflected through the lens of translation, which is what I'll try to show you. Yes, Klausnau often implied, like other Zionist thinkers, that Jews had fallen out of history after the Second Temple was destroyed. But he also underscored and made sure to remind the world or his readership that the Judaism of early Christians. So his essays often describe Jews first and foremost as the originators of monotheism and Christianity. And in that sense, his work is not so much an example of that link between Christian and Zionist thought that Raskar Kotskin is known to have explored. It is more of an attempt to work through that link, to transform its meaning. It is as if Klausnau knew that that link was paradoxical and attempted to explain it to his readership. And translation was crucial for that attempt. And this is something that Klausnau's biography of Jesus can illustrate. So here we have the biography. We're finally with the biography that I promised to be talking about. On the left is the Hebrew version, Yeshu HaNutzri. And then on the right is Danby's translation, Herbert Danby's translation, Jesus of Nazareth, His Lifetimes and Teaching. The Hebrew book was published in 1922 in Jerusalem, 2.5 years after Klausnau's migration to Palestine, and 4 years before he became a lecturer at the newly established Hebrew University in Jerusalem. Parts of the book had been adapted from Klausner's German doctoral dissertation and had already been published in journals in several languages. And I want to look at the book through that lens of translation. I think it's useful beyond the fact that parts of the book were actually translated from the German. I'm not going to get into that. The book's main claim is that Jesus's teachings in the New Testament were based on rabbinical exegesis. So that they were a translation or adaptation of rabbinic ideas. Later editions of the book also discussed the languages that Jesus knew and spoke, again, in order to highlight Jesus's Judaism. So Klausnau determines in later editions that Jesus must have known some Hebrew in addition to his Aramaic. And finally, the book was translated into several languages not long after its publication, which was precisely what Klausnau wanted. In fact, some of his critics in the Hebrew literary world mocked him for deliberately writing a book that was suitable for multiple audiences, that is, suitable for translation. And the book does explicitly seek to educate both Jews and non-Jews about Jesus's Judaism. That drawing of parallels between passages from the New Testament and passages from the Talmud is an illustration of what Klausnau was trying to do for multiple audiences. The book's English translation, which was an important translation from Klausnau's perspective, came out in 1925, and it was the result of a collaborative process between Klausnau and his English translator, the Anglican priest Herbert Danby. So who was Danby? He was a Bible scholar and missionary. He became church librarian and consultant to the bishop in St. George's Cathedral in Jerusalem in 1919. He stayed in Jerusalem until the early 1930s. He was very supportive of the Zionist cause in general and Jewish migration to Palestine in particular. Of course, the way those things were like at the time in the 1920s. And his Hebrew knowledge enabled him to strike friendships with figures just like Klausnau, these newly arrived intellectuals with a similar set of interests. And Danby was also a contributing reporter for the Times of London, editor of the Palestine Oriental Society periodical. So presumably he was very much attuned to demographic changes in Jerusalem. And he did become a friend of Klosnel's. His decision to translate Jesus of Nazareth, Klosnel's biography of Jesus, struck his superiors in the Anglican Church as suspicious. So letters from the archives of St. George's Cathedral, which the historian Shalom Goldman has uncovered, reveal that Danby had to explain his decision to translate Klosnel's book to church leaders. In one letter, for example, Danby confesses that for a while he couldn't quite decide whether his decision to contact Klosnel to translate his book was a good thing or a bad thing. This is a quote. But he quickly resolved that a translation of Klosner's work could have a positive effect on missionary efforts in Palestine. As Klosnel's book seemed to attest to Jewish curiosity about Christianity, it could give missionaries, and now I'm going to quote again, a long-wanted jumping-off place and an insight into the strength or weakness of the present educated Jewish opinion. Whether Danby shared these sentiments with Klosnel or his plan that missionary efforts would somehow benefit from the translation, that remains unknown. But there is no evidence of Klosnel feeling deceived. On the contrary, Klosnel took great pride in the book's translation, and this is something that he reports to his readers in the preface to the fourth edition of Jesus of Nazareth from 1933. He really brags in this preface about the book's success. He tells the story of the different translations that had come out and specifically celebrates the English translation, which sold twice as much as the first Hebrew edition. And so then he adds, and I have a quotation, I hope you can see it on your screens now. "Much sorrow and grief has the book, which the reader now holds, given its author. But I have derived spiritual satisfaction from the fact that the non-Jewish world had heard for the first time the voice of a Jew devoted to his religion and nation speaking about the strictly Jewish phenomenon called Jesus of Nazareth." So this is Klosnel in the preface of the fourth edition of Jesus of Nazareth. And he really repeats here the main claim of the book as a whole, that Jesus was a strictly Jewish phenomenon. Now, the grief to which he refers was the outcome of negative Hebrew reviews of the book. There were positive ones as well, but I'm going to mention the negative reviews. They either chastised Klosnel for his very choice to write about Christianity or dismissed the book as full of contradictions and unoriginal claims. So I'm going to quote, this is my translation of Micha Yosef Berdichevsky's review of the book, a famous Hebrew writer. He said of the book that it never delivers on its promise to dwell on the difference between Judaism and Christianity because it recycles previous arguments about their inseparability. So Klosnel presents Judaism and Christianity in the book, or in some places in the book, as a continuum. And that is something that Enlightenment writers had already done before him. And this led Berdichevsky to argue that there was nothing new about this book. And then a reviewer named Ephraim Deynald went in a very different direction and accused Klosnel of having struck a deal with missionaries. He knew about the relationship between Klosnel and Danby. And Klosnel writes about this review in his autobiography, and he insists that he never received any money from missionaries to write or translate the book on Jesus. But there's something new about Deynard's, this reviewer's statement that the missionaries could benefit maybe on some level from Klosnel's book, that of course should ring true to us now, because Danby was thinking the same thing and he was part of that story. as far as I can tell from my reading of historians' reports, so work that historians have done, the translated book did not really significantly change rates of Jewish conversion to Christianity in the 1920s. It was still, you know, just a book, an academic book at that. So yes, those don't really make a change in the world. But the book's English translation did make some waves, maybe stir some people at the church. We have a petition from 14 Anglican priests. So 14 is the number who signed that petition that called to banish Danby from Jerusalem. Nothing happened with that as well. I do think that the English translation was an academic event of sorts because it was a Jewish work about early Christianity and Jesus. So really an academic affair more than a watershed moment in the work of missionaries in Palestine, right? Here's an interviewer who, not an interviewer, a reviewer who reviewed the English translation of the work. This is A.W. Vernon in the New Republic, February 1926. It is likely that the book will be most prized for the numerous Jewish parallels to the sayings of Jesus, which this splendidly equipped writer gathers, and for the background of Jewish history and custom against which the figure of Jesus moves. There are many unfamiliar and illuminating, but alas, undated quotations from the Talmud. To those, however, who are familiar with the recent literature, there is little that is actually new concerning Jesus's times. The messianic unrest in Galilee, in particular, is pictured as more acute than is customary. Originality of thought is denied to Jesus utterly. There is no word of his that is not paralleled in Jewish sources. I'm not going to get into the content of specific parts of Klosner's book, like that messianic unrest in Galilee, because this is a talk about the story behind the translation. I want to look at the use of the term originality here. What the reviewer voices is sort of a sense of unease in the face of Klosner's insistence that Jesus never expressed an original thought. And indeed, Klosner presents Jesus's Judaism in the biography as some sort of an original text from which the historical figure was constantly translating. And this was really a pattern in Klosner's Zionist thought. I want to show you another review of sorts of the book. This is from an academic work on Jesus in Hebrew literature. And it's very recent, and it locates the book in the context of Klosner's work as a Jewish scholar of Christianity, whose Zionist agenda could not be missed. So this is Netta Stahl, and this is a book from not too long ago. According to Klosner, Jesus was not simply a Jew, but a Jew who belonged to his own land and was aware of his mission to claim the land for his people. In fact, it was the landscape itself that inspired him to become a national leader who guided his people toward both spiritual and political redemption. Klosner's Jesus embodies the new Jew: charisma, bravery, mastery of his own land, morality, and idealism. At the same time, this new Jew is also a poet, a man of fables and metaphors. So Stahl is suggesting that Klosner claimed Jesus not only for Judaism, but also for Zionism. And I would add to her claims about Klosner's biography of Jesus that those remarks that Klosner makes in later editions of the book on Jesus's knowledge of Hebrew. By suggesting that Jesus knew at least some Hebrew, Klosner sort of completes his portrayal as this exemplary new Jew. What is striking about Danby's translation is that it doesn't meddle with this portrayal of Jesus as a Jewish or Zionist hero. Danby's was what we might call a faithful translation, or is what we might call a faithful translation. Although he does translate the phrase the land of Israel as Palestine. Danby generally adhered to the translation norms of the time, which really did not allow for radical changes when someone was translating. I think these are still the norms today. He also had Klosno by his side occasionally when he was translating, so he could not presumably mistranslate the work or transform it completely. I think that all in all, that pair, writer and translator, got on well. And in many ways, it was Zionist thought that brought them together. Klosner clearly gained from Danby's translation not only fame as a scholar, but also an opportunity to spread these Zionist ideas that Stahl mentions in what is on the slide right now, and to spread them in the English-speaking world. And this is, again, on some level paradoxical, because Klosner is the kind of Zionist thinker who believed that only Hebrew could be a vehicle for Zionist thought, but he was nevertheless aware of the fact that Hebrew had limited potential to reach a mass readership, crucially of non-Jews, but not only of non-Jews, but also Jews in the English-speaking world. And the story of this English translation in America is a separate one, and we can talk about it briefly in the Q&A. Danby, of course, supported the Zionist message of Klosner's biography on some level. It's just that he viewed Zionism as some kind of a future opportunity for the mass conversion of Jews into Christianity. Of course, members of their respective communities saw Klosner and Danby's collaboration as wrong, even dangerous. But as I showed you in the beginning of this presentation, it was really not unusual to deem translation a dangerous act in the context of early 20th century Hebrew intellectual exchange. Klosner was the kind of writer who really embraced most acts of translation, particularly the translation of his own work. And he did find in Danby a friend. And so I'm about to conclude, but I want to say a few words about what this story always makes me think about in relation to some contemporary issues. It always makes me think about this contemporary unholy alliance between some Jews in Israel and some evangelicals in the United States and beyond, because despite deep theological differences, these groups can come together, like translator and writer, to advance their different versions, translations of the Zionist idea. And Klosner and Danby's collaboration in the 1920s anticipated this kind of Jewish-Christian alliance without coexistence, of course. I don't think any of them really wanted a kind of Jewish-Christian coexistence. I do have one more slide. Do I have time for it, or should we move on to the Q&A? So just really to tell you one more anecdote about Klosner, I want to tell you about another essay from Judaism and Humanism. In fact, the essay entitled Judaism and Humanism in this anthology that was published first in Hashiloah. In that essay, Klosner complains that no Hebrew writer ever produced a grand historical fictional exploration of married life of the kind Tolstoy produced in Anna Karenina. So here we have Anna Karenina, maybe even the translation that Klosner read. And Klosner does not mention in this article Anna Karenina explicitly, but the allusion is pretty obvious. He just complains about the absence of a Tolstoy in the Hebrew literary field. But that there was no Hebrew Tolstoy seemed especially baffling to Klosner, because Jewish tradition had so much to say about family, marriage, sexual relations out of wedlock, etc. So just like Frischmann, who you may recall conceived of Hebrew as a better medium to tell Bible-inspired stories, Klosner determines in that article, Judaism and Humanism, that Jewish sources are the best sources on which a writer could rely to examine married life in fiction. So he doesn't dub Hebrew literature not as strong or not as good as Russian literature when he compares Hebrew writers to Tolstoy. No, he implies that Hebrew literature is better. It's just dormant. He urges Hebrew writers to outperform Tolstoy by consulting Jewish sources, and really did believe that Jewish sources had more to say maybe than Christian thought about these issues, and why Christian thought, I mean, Tolstoy is really famous for incorporating Christian ideas into his modern fiction. And I read Klaus Nelson's idea about outperforming the Russian novelist as yet another attempt to argue that Judaism should be seen as that blueprint of Christianity, sort of an original behind a translation. And this is why Hebrew writers had to prove that whatever Christian thought has explored, Hebrew thought could explore better. And this is where I'll end, and I look forward to your questions.
Let me just open the Q&A panel. Just a reminder to anyone, if you do have a question, please type it in now. I think I've got nothing at the moment. And since, as Yaakov said, this is being recorded and will go out onto a podcast later. If you do not prefer your name to be mentioned when I ask your question, please just type that in the box as you type in. So in the meantime, while people are typing away, I hope, Daniel, I think I'd like to, if you don't mind, take the opportunity to ask the first question while we're waiting. As you know, I mean, we've discussed this in the past. I mean, Josef Klausner, for me, is very important as a revisionist figure. And to a certain degree, as a professor of Hebrew literature. But I suppose my question is this. You just mentioned at the very end, you talked about this kind of unholy alliance that you might between, let's say, the Ur-Christian Zionists and the ultra-nationalists, and it was something we still see today. But in the point of fact, it only goes so far, because really, in Christian ideology and Christian theology, the Christianity wins out. I mean, and that there's an essential, a problem there that you can't really get over. At some point, it has to be confronted. So I suppose my first question is, on what point? To what degree does he confront this? Because Klausner was a territorial maximalist. I mean, he was a hardcore revisionist. And I guess that leads me to also my next question. In spite of everything we've just talked about, how do you reconcile this Klausner as an ultra-nationalist, and Klausner as someone who, I mean, of all the things he'd want to do, his kind of best known work from himself is his book about Jesus.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think there's a joke about, is it the Yiddish writer Sholem Ash? Because there used to be a custom of writing on the tombstone the name of the most famous book of a writer, the title of that famous book. So Sholem Ash, I think that's him, used to joke that he'd have Jesus of Nazareth on his tombstone, because he also has a book about Jesus. Well, first of all, yes, I barely mentioned the fact that Klausner, and I did mention Jabotinsky, but I did not mention Klausner's intimacy with Jabotinsky. And I was rereading his autobiography, and the first thing he describes when he describes his arrival to Palestine, and this is the purpose is really to settle there. The first thing he sees is Jabotinsky looking dazzling in his uniform. So I think I'm not a historian, as I already said. From what I've read about Klausner as a revisionist, he never quite supported the revisionist movement beyond op-eds, sometimes what we might call today op-eds, and really his intellectual but also a friendship, his intellectual intimacy with Jabotinsky. And I think he did believe in all of Jabotinsky's ideas about what is it, the Iron Fist and everything, but the Iron Wall, sorry. when he writes about Zionism, he's on the defensive in many ways, which I think, again, that those discussions around translation capture that almost as a metaphor. He is always determined to prove that Judaism was there first, and therefore whatever is European about him personally, Jewish thought, Jabotinsky, who was such a European figure, and again, I'm using the adjective European as they used to, maybe, it's not a very narrow use, I know, maybe it's too broad, but But he always made sure to underscore the fact that Judaism was there first, and in fact was really at the basis of European culture in general, because European culture owes its genesis to Christianity, and Christianity owes its genesis to Judaism, and that was it. And whenever he's accused of being too radical politically, and his autobiography makes that very clear, he just goes on the defensive. And it's the same with Jesus of Nazareth, the book, to answer your question about that. He was defending his position as a scholar. And there's another famous story about Klosner. He wanted to teach Second Temple Judaism at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. And he, I think, was sure that he would get that job because he had already published so much about that. And he completed his dissertation at the University of Heidelberg. And he writes about that time in Heidelberg as a time in which he really realized that he was such an excellent writer and thinker. And he was writing in German, which was definitely not his first language. And then he didn't get that job. He got the job of teaching modern Hebrew literature. And so students of modern Hebrew literature, like myself, usually start with, you know, reading some of Klosner's work, or really today, just scholarship on Klosner's work, or that already incorporates Klosner's work into the historiography of modern Hebrew literature. But he always felt like he was undervalued as a scholar of Second Temple and early Christianity. So I would say he continued to take pride, as I said in my presentation, in that work of his. I don't think it bothered him that he was known for that work. Again, I mean, to him it was proof that a Jew could write about Jesus maybe better than others, because a Jew had access to those Talmudic texts that he really viewed as the original behind Jesus's translations. I hope that answers your question.
So it just prompts a couple more questions for me, if that's okay.
Yeah, I have a question. Can I jump in and ask a question?
Sure.
Let me put myself on. Danielle, thank you so much for this fascinating talk, and so much to think about and to really be excited about, wanting you to go on discussing. So I want to make maybe a general comment, and then to ask two questions somewhat related to this. It's very interesting to think of Klosner as a Ahad Ha'am's student or protege, even to a degree, right? To inherit Hashiloach from him. Specifically because when you read Ahad Ha'am's writings generally, but specifically his critique of Herzl, the one thing that Ahad Ha'am just cannot accept is how European Herzl's imagination of the new society or Altneuland is. He uses European as a derogatory term to say everything I look around in the book is European, and then Klausner comes and is, you know, try to in a sense appropriate Europeanness in a sense. But even more to the point, you should know, everybody, I mean, most of our attendees should know, but just to make it, you know, to remind ourselves, Ahad Ha'am gets into a severe fight, is trying to censor Yosef Chaim Brenner, because Brenner argues that reading the Christian Biblia, reading the Christian literature, is a Jewish exercise because it's reading a Jewish literature. And Ahad Ha'am sees this as breaking a taboo of Hebrew-Jewish nationalism. And then his protege, in a sense, goes on to write a book about Jesus and makes his name out of, you know, as a Jesus biographer. So that's a very interesting point that I would ask you to comment on, this relationship with Ahad Ha'am and how he understood this. The second question is, in a sense, wider. And it's much more speculative, but I think there's always flowing and undercurrent flowing under these discussions, which we rarely mention, and you mentioned, and I appreciate it. I really love it that you mentioned, but I ask you to expand on it. And this undercurrent is Russia, Russianness, Russian identity. These are all Russian Jews, right? Except for no one. They have a Central European education, and they go to Germany to study, but Russian-ness of the time specifically has this complicated relationship with its own identity and with Europeanness. For Russians to view themselves as European is actually a cultural appropriation in a sense, or you know, self-imagining that is extremely important. And Russianness also built itself in a sense vis-a-vis or against the Jew, which obviously so many of the Zionists accept as a framework for thinking. So how do you see this as playing out, this, I guess the Russian background for all this?
Right. Yeah, no, these are very good questions that are going to help me improve this chapter that I'm working on at the moment, because one of my thoughts working on this chapter had been for a while now, should I really relate maybe also to the Brenner affair that you mentioned? It's usually referred to as the Brenner affair, and now I know I should. So just a comment on Klausner as Achad HaAm's protege. I think there's some writing about it. Historians have grappled with this question, and I was thinking about it reading Achad HaAm and reading about Achad HaAm, who became kind of depressed in the final years of his life. I think when Achad HaAm gave away HaShiloach, and this is based on, you know, historians' work and works by Achad HaAm himself, he was just really tired of editing that journal, and Klausner was really energetic. That's what I think really happened there. If I read some of Achad HaAm's work from after the time that he was that founding and really legendary editor of HaShiloach. So Klausner had already sent a few articles. Achad HaAm could see that he was very confident, which is something that Achad HaAm maybe lacked. You know, this sense of long-standing, ongoing self-confidence. And this is not a psychoanalytical, you know, observation. In fact, it has a lot to do with what you said, Yaakov, about Herzen and Achad HaAm. Because Achad HaAm is worried in the early 20th century. You know, he writes his essays like Imitation and Assimilation that has his manifesto about Zionism in the late 1890s. And then in the early 1900s, as Zionism becomes more and more popular, he really is worried that it's going in the direction that it eventually went. Maybe Herzlian Zionism, the kind of Zionism that Herzl represented. And it was very European, as you said. So maybe that's my only solution to that conundrum of what really happened there with Achad HaAm. He just sort of, maybe he just lets go at some point because it's too much. It's going in a direction that he cannot identify with. And that direction is very European. By the way, Achad HaAm really didn't think that Hebrew literature should have any kind of poetic works in it whatsoever, so let alone translations. And he becomes livid when a translation of The Vicar of Wakefield, an English pastoral novel, comes out, and it's Goldsmith's novel. And Achad HaAm just doesn't understand why would any Hebrew reader be interested in some English family in the countryside that goes bankrupt. You know, that's the story. But he does recommend translating a different work by Goldsmith in that same essay, The Citizen of the World, which is very different. It's not a poetic work per se, it's an epistolary novel, and very, you know, it's like Montesquieu's Persian Letters. It's in the tradition of the Enlightenment. Now that brings me to Russia on some level. Now these are the two languages I wish I knew on a personal level, Arabic and Russian. And, you know, having grown up in Israel, these are really the languages that someone should have taught me, but I don't know them. There are scholars of modern Hebrew literature who are also Russian readers, and I think their numbers are growing, and that makes a difference for the study of modern Hebrew literature, because you are very right to point out that the Russian connection is extremely important. And as I said, when Bialik translates Don Quixote, it's based on a Russian and a German two adaptations of Cervantes's very famous Spanish novel. So I think what I could say is that Hebrew writers align themselves with the kind of Russian writers and thinkers who do identify Russia with Europe or wanted it to go in that direction. So from what I can see, they think of Russia as part of Europe for the most part. And then there is a whole there are Russian politics that may contradict that, but I'm not sure I am a good person to comment on that. But yes, I mean, there is some work being done on it. I just found a great article about Gnesin, who was one of Brenner's best friends, a Hebrew writer, and how his entire work really owed to Russian literature, its motifs and its style. Yeah. So yeah. Hope that answers the question.
Thank you.
Okay. So Danielle, I guess following on from that, I've got a question from someone who asks, is Zionism then a European translation of Judaism? It's a good question.
Yeah, I like that. Can I use it in my manuscript?
They're anonymous, so why not?
Yes, this is the kind of metaphor that I plan to work with. I mean, really, all these paradoxes, you know, Zionism was supposed to put an end to assimilation. Maybe it's, you know, the best way to assimilate was to imitate those European structures just elsewhere. So is Zionism actually assimilation? Scholars like Daniel Boyarin have written about that. And then translation enters this discussion readily because translation is often debated in that context of assimilation. So if Zionism is a movement that is supposed to put an end to assimilation, should it translate? This is one of the questions that I plan to deal with in this work in progress. So yes, I mean, I like that reworking of the presentation by an anonymous participant.
Who is giving you the permission to use the...
Yeah,
that's right.
Thank you.
So I wonder if we have any other questions. And if not, I have another question. If there are no other questions, we used to wrap up the seminar. I'm going to go back to what you said before, and we're talking about this kind of the downplaying, let's say, of Klausner's nationalist or ultra-nationalist, I would say, personally. I don't totally agree about the fact that he downplayed it. I mean, he was a revisionist without, and quite proudly so. I mean, he was he led the Western Wall campaign, you know, in the wake of the 1929 Arab riots. I mean, it was Klausner who spearheaded the campaign and led it. But also, I'm thinking of an article, and I really hope I'm not wrong, because I'm going on kind of very dusty memories now. But back when I was doing my own doctoral thesis, I read an article by Klausner about Hanukkah, the Hashmonim, and he really, like many other ultra-nationalists, look to this as actually a proud moment in Jewish nationalist history, because they tried to defend themselves, and it kind of like the Masada thing, you know, they defended themselves, you know, even though they got defeated, they tried very, very hard to defend themselves. So I think, I don't know if I mean, he goes past Jesus' viewpoint, for lack of a better way of saying it, on an ideological level, I think, and I just want so...
If I gave the impression that he was, you know, downplaying it, it's not what I meant exactly. I mean, I do think that, well, he doesn't like to be associated with, let's say, overt or explicit political debate, at least as he describes it in some of his autobiographical works and the prefaces to his other scholarly works, because he wants to be seen, or he wanted to be seen, as a scholar, which is why I mentioned that anecdote from the days that he was waiting to be appointed as a lecturer at the Hebrew University and ended up getting that job that he didn't want, of teaching modern Hebrew literature, and later he got to teach what he wanted to teach. And he is, and he was definitely, and I hope I made it clear in the presentation itself, there was no other solution as far as Klausner was concerned to that Jewish question. It was only migration, and it was Jews' rights. It was their historical right. It was their historical calling. He calls it Te'udat Israel, the calling, the destination of Jews in general, to really take over the entire space. So the two banks of the Jordan, and it's unambiguous. I agree with you, Peter, and you're the historian here, and you probably know these things better. And that's what I see when I read Klosnell, to insert him into that literary story that I'm trying to tell, because he is a very important figure in the Hebrew literary world as well. But there is a tension there. And again, it's the same tension as with, you know, translation. All of these writers are also Zionist figures, and literature and politics often have this uneasy relationship. And clearly, literary work is always part of the political world, implicated in it, influenced by it, and maybe even has the power to change it slowly, gradually. I don't know, but the fact that Hebrew literature at the turn of the 20th century is also a political arena does not mean that everyone involved feels comfortable with it. And so this is what I meant to highlight, and that's from the point of view of someone who studies mainly literature, that Klosnell, when he's asked about politics, when he was asked about politics, especially in the context of literary and scholarly activity, he would sometimes, you know, at least, you know, downplay some parts of it. But yes, I mean, he writes about Zionism in Jabotinskian terms, and I'm sure they were reading one another. And again, you know better. So thank you for that.
Yakov, one more. Go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you, Peter, for allowing this. I want to ask a question and to remind you something. So the question I have actually relates to a theme that comes up in almost all of our meetings in this seminar series. It's a question of monolingualism. These all are ideologues working in a multilingual situation where they are building a monolingual entity. Maybe they don't know, maybe they don't think so. Some of them were obviously committed to this. But can you say something about the way they negotiate this tension between a nationalist focus on one language as everything, yeah, even to the degree that you look, that they would look negatively on translations, and then the reality in which they live, in which it's more than bilingualism for sure for most of them, right? I mean, it's Hebrew, Yiddish, Russian, German. And second, you promised to say something about the election. We're all sitting on edge, and you can say something.
I said, no, not at all. I said, just like, you know, I, from the literary world, I shall not say anything political. No, I said that I might say a few things about Israel and America, which I did in that form of my comment on how this Dan B. Klosnell encounter always makes me think about Mike Pompeo visiting Israel. Right. So this is just my association. And I think, Peter, you also, you know, as another historian in the room, you told me that I should be very aware of, I think, in between the lines of the time that has passed and the different iterations of that unholy alliance. So that was an aside. But yes, multilingualism is another major tension that is similar to that tension that translation both represents and generates in modern Hebrew literature at the turn of the 20th century and really in Zionist thought too, early Zionist thought. So paradoxically, and this goes beyond the Jewish context, multilingualism often contributes to the advance of monolingual realities. This is how translation works, actually. So in order, let's say for a cultural group, a national group to read whatever it wants to read in its own language, if we can talk of language, about languages as something that we own, that we possess, then you need those multilingual agents to translate everything into that language. Otherwise, it's complete isolation, which is not something that, you know, we really know as humans, I think, or I mean, and I'm happy that this is the case, that we're not completely isolated culturally. So this is a structural paradox when it comes to translation, that you need multilingual agents to generate monolingual realities. And it's not unusual that national movements or nationalist movements have this robust enterprise of translation to support their nationalism. So there are many other examples, and they're fascinating, of these translation enterprises, sometimes of reclaiming what the colonizer had already translated into the colonizer's language. What I read, India had this major translation enterprise at the time of decolonization, which is by definition, at least on some level, a time of nationalization. I mean, different stories, of course. So this is not unusual. But another aspect of translation is that it doesn't quite let us forget that multilingualism exists. So yes, it does advance monolingualism, but it's that liminal space. I mentioned Yair Volach's talk here, and he said at the end of his talk that we live in a world that rewards monolingualism rather than multilingualism. And I think it's true that we live in a world that is dominated by a monolingual paradigm, meaning that every person should have a single language that defines him or her. That's supposed to be the norm. Of course, it's not the norm. And even the photographs that we saw in Yair's lecture from Jerusalem, you can see that actually there are always cracks in that monolingual reality. There's other languages always creep in. I think if there's anything that is conspicuously missing from these writers' works, the Hebrew writers at the turn of the 20th century, it's Arabic. Because if they address Arabic, it's always a language of the past, even if when they're already in Palestine. It's the language that, medieval Jewish poets knew, used, and then it's maybe also worthy of translation. But I'm sure others have found things, but there's so little about Arabic in their work. While they do grapple with the fact that they know other languages, and this is another tension, the tension that you just mentioned in that world of translation and Zionism that I'm interested in.
Great, Danielle, I think that's a good place to end. I want to thank you for your talk very, very much. I say, and next week we'll be able to, or next time we'll be able to talk about the results of the American election, I hope with a happy face. I just remind you that next week we go back to the Israel Studies Seminar, and Dr. Yuval Jobani and Nachshon Peretz will be talking about Palestinian Arab citizens in Israel, equality struggle. And then in 2 weeks from today, we return to the Reconsidering Early Jewish Nationalist Ideology Seminar, and Dr. Yuval Ivry will talk about the return to Al-Andalus disputes over Sephardic culture and identity between Arabic and Hebrew. Danielle, it's been a real
just
pleasure.
Just to correct...
Yaakov, you're back?
I'm back just to correct. Nachshon Peretz and Yuval Jobani are talking about sacred places and the regulation of sacred places. Must have been a confusion of titles. Yes.
Yeah, you're right. That's my mistake. I can't read. Reading was not a big part of my doctoral studies. So, okay. I'm really sorry about that. You're absolutely right. It's also reading everything in a very dim light. Anyway, Danielle, I want to thank you very much for your wonderful contribution. And yes, thank you so much.
Thank you, Yaakov. Thank you, Peter. Thank you for inviting me.